Today is the first day of this June 2009 7-day session at Chaitanya Mill. And for the first few days of this session, we're going to be reading from Cultivating the Empty Field, the Silent Illumination of Zen Master Hongzhe, translated by Taigen Daniel Layton with Yi Wu. I'm going to be taking up where I left off at the end of the January session in Auckland. But because most of you weren't there, we'll just do have a little bit of biographical information about Hongzhe. Hongzhe's full name is Hongzhe Zhengjue, and his dates are 1091 to 1157. He's a Chinese master. His Japanese name is Wan Shi Shogaku. And just to kind of locate him in history, William the Conqueror invaded Britain in 1066. He was teaching about 100 years before Master Dogen was alive, and he is the great-great uncle in the Dharma to Dogen. He was a successor to Dan Xia Zichen, who is in our ancestral line, but our line continues down to Dogen and through Dogen from a Dharma brother of Hongzhe. He's a very important figure in Sao Dong Chang in Soto Zen. He was a poet, a very eloquent writer, and perhaps most importantly, he was the compiler of the cases that make up the Shoyoroku, and added a verse to each koan. Didn't have the name Shoyoroku when he put it together. That was given to the text 100 years later by the second person involved in creating the text. Shoyoroku means the Book of Serenity, and that was the name of the hut in which the second author of the text worked. His Japanized name is Bansho. I don't remember the Chinese right now. Hongzhe was an approximate contemporary with the Linji master Yuan Wu Keqin, who of course was one of the authors of the Hekigon Roku, the Blue Cliff Record. And Hongzhe actually spent some time at Yuan Wu's temple. Just a little bit about his life. He became a monk when he was 11. And at the age of 18, he studied under Kumu Fa Cheng, whose dates is 1071 to 1128, who was a Dharma brother of Dan Xia Zichen, who he became a successor to. This Kumu Fa Cheng, his name meant dry wood, complete Dharma. And he had this name because he sat in meditation so still that his body was said to resemble a block of dry wood. And the author here, Layton, says, Hongzhe emulated this practice of upright, immobile meditation throughout his career. He, after a few years with this dry wood master, he traveled to other temples and spent some time on Shangshan mountain. This Shangshan means incense. So Shangshan temple, incense mountain temple. And one day while he was there, he overheard a monk reciting a line from the Flower Ornament Sutra, the Hua Yan scripture. And the line was, "The eyes which our parents give us can behold 3,000 worlds." And on hearing this, Hongzhe experienced an initial awakening. When Hongzhe told the master, who was as often the case, called after the mountain that he was abbot at, so he was called Master Shangshan. When he told him of his experience, this Master Shangshan pointed to a box of incense and said, "What is inside?" Hongzhe said, "What does mind do?" Shangshan then asked, "Where does your enlightenment come from?" Hongzhe drew a circle in the air with his hand and threw it behind him. Shangshan then said, "You are a man who produces muddiness. What is your capacity?" Hongzhe said, "Mistake." Shangshan said, "Don't show other people." And Hongzhe said, "Yes, yes." The author here then adds, "Such dialogues have their own logic and function most effectively with minimal explanation." And then he goes on to explain it somewhat, which we're not going to read. But he makes the comment that Dogen would echo Hongzhe when he called his own life one continuous mistake. Elsewhere in Dogen's writings, he talked about the necessity for one who is in training to experience repeated failure. When Shangshan says, "You are a man who produces muddiness, what is your capacity?" he's testing Hongzhe. The way that we respond to this kind of testing is very revealing of where we are in our training. Hongzhe says, "Mistake." Mistake. There's so much in that. How we work with the mistakes we make is really a matter of life or death. To face our mistakes, accept our mistakes, is to turn them into wisdom. To not face them, to try and avoid them, is to compound the mistake. Another example of this is Hakuin, who as a young man had what he thought was a profound awakening experience. He confessed himself in his writings that he felt like it was greater than any awakening that had happened in hundreds of years. It was just brimful of this experience. And he went to a master called Shoju Rojin to demonstrate his understanding. And this Shoju Rojin just kept on calling him a poor cave-dwelling devil. Every time he came before him, he would just say, "Oh, you sniveling cave-dwelling devil," and send him away. Hakuin didn't give up at that point, but went deeper. Stayed with him for months, going through this abuse. There's no other word for it. But he kept coming back. He kept probing his mind, and after about 8 months came to a deeper realization. When we're pushed in this way by a teacher, we have a choice about how we respond. We need to push back to go beyond the personal. When masters do this, when they don't accept our realization, they are really doing it out of their faith in our ability to go deeper. Even if they're not, it's up to us how we use it. Even just plain old abuse, mistreatment, we can use that. We can use it to look more deeply. Think also of Master Joshu, Zhao Zhou, who when he set out on pilgrimage, he said, "If I meet a 100-year-old who I can teach, I will teach him or her. If I meet a child who can teach me, I will become that child's student." In making this statement, he was really going against the norms of the day, Confucian norms, which were respect for elders and responsibility towards people younger. He was saying, no, there's a deeper principle. If I can learn from somebody, I will. I will submit to them. If somebody more senior than me that I can teach, I'll teach them. It's a very fine teaching in the Vajrayana school, teaching of patience. And this is elaborated particularly in Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva. It talks about how a bodhisattva responds to ill treatment and how it is an opportunity not to be missed, because it is only when we are mistreated, when we are abused, that we can develop patience. As long as things are going along nicely and smoothly, we can't. We actually can't. And patience is one of the six paramitas. It's an essential ingredient or aspect of our awakening. So if we can summon enough resources to remember this, then our whole attitude towards abuse can change. Of course, timing is important here. And it's true that teachers make mistakes about this too. They may push too hard at times before the student is ready. You can be sure that this is very painful to the teacher when he or she recognizes it. Take us back to this exchange between Shang Shan and Hong Zhe. Mistake. There's this motto that can be very useful that Master Shen Yin mentions about how we deal with things in our life. He says, face it, accept it, deal with it, let it go. First of all, we've got to face a mistake, whether it's a mistake we made or something that we feel somebody has done to us which is unhelpful. Face that. Have to face it first before we can do anything else. If we're running from it, it can't be transformed. So face it, then accept it. This can be very hard. If you make a mistake, if you cause some harm to somebody else or to yourself, it can be very hard just to face up to that. It's painful. It takes courage. It takes courage to do this practice, to fail over and over again. Face it, accept it, then deal with it. Look into it, see it deeply, understand the causes, its roots, understand its roots. But then, let it go. Move on. At about the age of 23, Hong Zhe left Shang Shan and moved on to the temple of Danxia Zichen. Danxia asked him, "What is yourself before the empty kalpa?" Now, a kalpa is an immeasurably long period of time, an eon. And in Buddhist cosmology, each universe exists for a cycle of four kalpas: the empty, the becoming, the abiding, and the decaying. So the empty kalpa mentioned in this question is the first of these four, from emptiness there's a move into becoming or unfolding, then abiding, enduring, and then decaying, dying. And these are incredibly long periods of time, these kalpas. One definition of a kalpa is the time it takes for a heavenly being to come down and wear away a mountain, if she comes down once every 100 years and brushes the top of this huge mountain with a silk scarf. So when Danxia asks this question, what was your, is yourself before the empty kalpa, it's very similar to other koan. What is your original face before your parents gave birth to you, but put into cosmic timescales? So what is yourself before the empty kalpa? Hongzhe replied, a frog in a well swallows the moon. At midnight, I do not borrow a lantern. Dansya said, not yet. Pushed back again. As Hongzhe was about to respond, Dansya beat him with his whisk and asked, do you still say you do not borrow? Hongzhe experienced some understanding and bowed. Dansya said, why don't you make a statement? Hongzhe said, today I lost money and was punished. Dansya said, I have no time to beat you up. Hongzhe then spent several years studying with Dansya, following him as he moved from one temple to another, and then receiving his Dharma transmission from him before he died. He then went on to live in various temples, but finally ended up at Jingde Temple, this is Bright Virtue Temple or Monastery on Mount Tiantong. This is the same Tiantong that Dogen was to later come to and study under Ru Jing. When Hongzhe arrived, the monastery was small and not in good shape, and under his supervision it was reconstructed and eventually came to accommodate 1,200 monks. Its huge meditation hall could hold all the monks drawn to Hongzhe's rich teaching, and he seems to have been unflappable amid the difficulties of this expansion. From that point on, he just stayed on this in this temple, on this mountain. It was a time of civic unrest in China, and on several occasions he distributed food from the temple to the surrounding area, saving many villages from starvation. Then in 1157 he came down the mountain for the first time in 30 years and went to visit local military and government officials and lay patrons of the temple to say goodbye and thank them for their support. And then when he returned to Jingde Temple, he took a bath, put on clean robes, went into the Dharma Hall and gave a talk, farewell talk to his monks. Then he asked for a brush and wrote a letter to his colleague and also sometime critic, the Zen teacher Da Hui, Zhong Gao. Da Hui was a Dharma heir of Yuan Wu's. And he asked Da Hui, who was like Yuan Wu, a Rinzai master, he asked him to take charge of his affairs and his temple when he died. And his death verse was as follows. Illusory dreams, phantom flowers, 67 years, a white bird vanishes in the mist, autumn waters merge with the sky. And then he passed away sitting in Zazen. Thank you. now to our text. Now these consist of short paragraphs of practice instructions. The first of these paragraphs is entitled "The Ancient Ferry Boat in Bright Moonlight," and these titles were added by the translator based on material in each of the passages. And what we'll do is read the short passage and then look into it closely, because each of these is really full of useful instruction. The Ancient Ferry Boat in Bright Moonlight. A patch-robed monk's authentic task is to practice the essence in each minute event, carefully discerning the shining source, radiant without discrimination, one colour unstained. You must keep turning inward, then the source is apprehended. This is called being able to continue the family business. Do not wear the changing fashions. Transcend the duality of light and shadow. Accordingly, the ancestors' single trail is marvelously embodied. The residual debris of the world departs, its influence ended. This worldly knowledge does not compare to returning to the primary and obtaining confirmation. Observing beyond your skull, the core finally can be fulfilled and you can emerge from the transitory. The reeds blossom under the bright moon. The ancient ferry boat begins its passage. The jade thread fits into the golden needle. Then the opportunity arises to turn around into the world and respond to conditions. All dusts are entirely yours. All the dharmas are not someone else's. Follow the current and paddle along, naturally unobstructed. Okay, let's just take the first couple of sentences here. A patch-robed monk's authentic task is to practice the essence, in each minute event, carefully discerning the shining source, radiant without discrimination, one colour unstained. You must keep turning inward, then the source is apprehended. When we hear this a patched robed monk, really what it means is a sincere practitioner, somebody who is committed to realizing the way. So he's talking about all of us. A patch-robed monk's authentic task is to practice the essence. What does it mean to practice the essence? Probably the main thing that Hongzhe was teaching would have been what we now call shikantaza. In Chinese, it's referred to as silent illumination. This is mentioned in the subtitle of this book, "The Silent Illumination of Zen Master Hongzhe." We can see this in this next line that he has here. In each minute event, carefully discerning the shining source. This is the practice of shikantaza, just moment by moment, sitting with whatever is present. without discrimination. He says, radiant without discrimination, one color, unstained, experiencing whatever arises without breaking it up into this and that. Taking it all in. But we can apply this practicing the essence to all the practices that people here in this session are doing. Shikantaza, working on a koan, hearing, breath practice. To practice the essence means to be present. To keep returning to the absolute reality of each moment. And within that, within each moment, having the faith that it is, as it is, the shining source. It is Buddha nature. Whatever comes up is true nature. If we don't separate from it, if we don't discriminate, he says, you must keep turning inward, and then the source is apprehended. Our usual way of using our mind is the opposite. We to turn outward. We think that we are experiencing things that are outside ourselves, and then we either react to them with attachment if they're pleasant things, things we like, or if we have judged them to be unpleasant things, then we react with aversion. And in either of these cases, we turn this unstained one color into a divided world, into a world of self and other. So practice is returning to the essence of oneness, the essence of no thingness. In the commentary to the first case in the Mumon Kan, Joshu's Mu, Mumon says that we must cut off the mind road. This is the mind of discrimination, the mind that divides. How do we do that? Master Hongzhe sets it out for us here, but it's still pretty elusive. It doesn't get into the nuts and bolts of how we go about this. For instance, nowhere in these instructions, they're called practice instructions, does he talk about posture, about sitting. Presumably because it was just a given, everybody would understand the importance of that. Posture is so important. in practice. In Western culture, we tend to divide things into physical and the spiritual. We think of Zen practice being spiritual work. But actually, we could equally say that Zen practice, Zazen, is physical work. Can't separate these two, actually. So we really start with the body. It may be helpful just to review the basic points about posture. Number one, we need a stable base. We need at least 3 points of contact with the mat or the chair and the floor if we're sitting in a chair. Without stability, we can't rest. We can't settle. So this is very important. Next thing, once we've found that stability, is to adjust the angle of the pelvis. This is important because if we don't have it at the right angle, then we won't be able to sit up straight easily. And this is really essential. If we want to sustain the practice, we have to find this balance that enables us to sit up straight without strain. So getting the pelvis at the right angle to have a straight back is really important. And the way we do that is getting the right kind of relationship between our knees and our hips. Our hips must be at least a little bit higher than the knees, so that the pelvis, the angle of the pelvis is correct, so that then we can have our trunk be perfectly upright. Actually, that doesn't mean ramrod straight, it means a slight curve, an S curve, a slightly concave lower back and a slightly convex upper back. So always when you sit down, once you've got your legs in the right way, to lean forward and lengthen the backs of the thighs so that there is this curve in the lower back. And then to come up from that leaning forward and sway a little bit from side to side to find the central point in the sideways plane there. And also look for a kind of openness in the chest. If your back isn't straight and your head is forward, then you won't have that kind of open-hearted ease, which is essential for effective Zazen. So to just take the time to check your posture when you first sit down and really soften it. If you have a straight back where all the vertebrae are supporting each other, then everything can be soft, just hanging like clothing on a coat hanger, just completely without tension, everything. Just this beautiful pillar holding us up. And when we find that, then we'll just find that naturally our ears will line up with our shoulders. The chin will be tucked in, and the back of the neck will be up against the collar. Again, it's important to make sure that this is soft. Sometimes we just want to get into that position and we'll push our head back, and that will create tension in the neck. So it needs to be soft. Think of if you look at the way lily is sitting on the top of its straight stalk. It's got this flexible, easeful quality to it. Or you look at those geese that we have here at the moment. Look at especially the two parent geese when they're sitting at attention, watching vigilantly around to keep an eye on their 13 babies. Their necks are beautifully straight, but at the same time, flexible, with that slight S-curve in it. They look like they're doing shikantaza, those geese. Just completely vigilant, poised, ready to respond if necessary, to protect their guardians. Their charges, rather. Once we have established our seat, a straight posture, then the next thing is regulating the mind. And rather than launch into that now, since our time is nearly up, we'll stop here and recite the four vows.